And the other one was where you defecated, and it was burnt. You burned that. It always burnt, so it was always, there wasn't any of that either. Well, there's no place to put it. It wouldn't, I'll bet you anything, I told this flyer from Beach Sandy that landed on Shemmy not too long ago. They got a new airport there. It's just a little island, 4 miles long, and 2 miles wide. You can walk around in no time, but I said, well, it's probably, I bet those holes are still there full of pee. Yeah, he said, they told us not to get off of anything that wasn't solid because the GIs have been there. But other than that, well, we get on the, I did find a little barrel. I think it probably held 2 gallons, maybe 3, but 2 would be closer to it. And it was waxed. So I took it up, and it was a priest. I said, well, I don't know what's in this, but I see it's Japanese. And he said, I'll bet you sake. So he dug and scraped that, sure enough, that's what it was. So I said, well, you'll need that for your people to, whatever you Catholics do with it. So he took it. I never did like it. I got some of it over in Germany, and I didn't like that stuff at all, not the flavor of it. But it was, it's the only thing. Then we get on the beach. Now on ADAC, where we built the docks, we went out, I think it was 900 foot, and we had 5 of them. And the water is pretty shallow, so they bring a ship in, they could bring it in and unload them. One morning we went down there, and they were all gone. All of them were gone. And what they built it on a shelf that went way out, and then come back like that, as the water where it broke off was 2,300 foot deep. That's where the water was. So if any of us had been anywhere close to that, it would have sucked us under, you'd never made it. It'd all been gone. But it happened in the night. That was all there was to it.
Did you have any contact with different groups of people in the Pacific?
No, none whatsoever. Not where, you know, the Lutes were the only ones that had been up there. So in Alaska, of course, we were there. Well, it was a territory. And got acquainted with Alaska Nellie, probably the most famous woman other than Sacagawea that I've ever read about or known about. And I met her and talked to her many times. She had... the most famous thing was a coat, jacket, full-length jacket made out of just the white part of a wolf. And she killed these wolves herself, either with an axe, shot them, and that's the one she took and made this. She was very famous. Alaska woman was Alaska Nellie. She lived up north of Seward a few miles, and I was up there talking to her, and one time, and all of a sudden, ding, ding, ding. I said, what in the heck is that? You have no electricity here, nothing. Oh, she said, a fish just bought. She said, you want a fresh trout? She had that bait down in the creek, just off to one side. And when that fish grabbed that bait, coming up there, it rang a little bell, and she pulled it in. Gosh, that trout was that long. So she fried it up for us.
It was about 2 feet?
Yeah, she was quite the gal. She had so many things that she had done in the early days in Alaska. And of course, I had a lot of stories in Alaska long before her. My wife's grandpa was in the rush in 98 up there. And he got as far as Bennett Lake, and they just... run out of time. He said the one thing that he found out that he always laughed. He was an old guy. He lived to be 97, but he was this steep hill. If you ever seen that picture, anyhow, they had to take all their stuff up this hill on top, and there was a tent up there, and there was a man up there. So he got up there on his third trip, and he was just dead tired. He asked him, can I just stay, lay on the floor, and it won't bother you, won't be any trouble whatsoever. And, no, no, you can't. She said, I'm a woman. So, it took him by surprise, but he slept outside the tent. But, it did remind me of a story. You don't mind another story, do you, about earlier? I was, when I first went out there, my father-in-law, well, and Mr. Weller was one of them, the old fellow, my wife's grandpa, and they'd over east about 40 miles, they were cutting juniper for fence posts, that old juniper. And here was a woman lived over there that she raised goats and milk, and she had four daughters. And they were all, I suppose, teenagers. And anyhow, they wanted to know if they could stay there. And she said, oh, no. She said, people will gossip. And he said, well, there's anyone within, we're the closest, 50 miles. Oh, yes, I know. But she said, there's a cabin down there about 4 or 5 miles. You guys can stay in there. So she didn't want anyone to gossip about a bunch of guys coming in, all married. They wouldn't have touched any of those girls. But she didn't want anyone to gossip about a bunch of guys being there, you know, and those girls there and her. No, she didn't have a man. So I suppose he died or left or something. She was down there all by herself, way down in the breaks. So that's kind of, Mr. Weller always said, you know, he said, I run into those things out and there where they didn't want me to stay. He said, I'm honest as the day is long, and he was. He wouldn't have bothered anyone, but you know how that is. People in those years were pretty suspicious. It isn't like it is now. They probably welcome me in. But that's you. What's your next question?
Did the military tell you anything about the Japanese?
Pardon me?
Did the military tell you anything about the Japanese?
Yeah, they did. To a certain extent, they said they were masters of karate, and they knew all of that stuff, and if they wanted us to learn some things, so we did, you know. Where you grab a hold of a guy and run backwards and then fall right over and pull him with him and kick him up in the air, and when he come down, kick him in the head. And a few things like that that I said, well, as long as I got a rifle and a bayonet, I'm not worried about the Japanese getting a hold of me whatsoever, because he's going to get it. And those are the days when you bayoneted a man, you had to save one round. Because if you stuck a bayonet in your back, a lot of times the wedge in there, you couldn't get it out, so you had to shoot it off. That was what that round was for. But, no, that was about the only thing that the Army warned you about, that they were good at, I don't know what they called it, but my son's a black belt, he's a third degree, and he teaches karate out there on the ranch. We have a gym. And I know what karate is. I never got a black belt because you're really limited, you know. If my son put his arm on your shoulder, you could have him arrested. That's a felony. You cannot monkey with a black belt. So I never ever got one brown belt. I'm not afraid anyhow of anybody. I take care of myself. I still like to. I'm strong. If you don't think so, just grab me, you'll find out. No? What else we got?
What did the military say about the Japanese civilians?
Well, other than, of course, we didn't hear anything about that, but they locked all those up, you know, California, and had their special, and they had them out our way. Japanese are a few families, and hell, they've been there they've been citizens for many, many years, but they're still figured that they might have contact with someone that wasn't. So they locked them up or put them in muddy places, you know, to keep them same as the prisoners, Germans later on, and the beet fields out of Chinook, they had them out there. No, other than that, well, I didn't know anything about them, about the Japanese.
What did you think of the internment camps?
Well, I, like, just like I said, if you're a citizen, and those people are paying taxes, and they'd been there a long time, and the neighbors knew them, they'd raised their kids, I could see nothing wrong with that. But now they're letting in millions of these people that are, they're letting their convicts go, they know that, out of their prisons, and we're getting them. What's gonna happen now?
What were your thoughts and feelings when you received orders to leave for the European theater?
Wasn't that what?
I didn't. What are your thoughts or feelings when you got orders to go to Europe?
Oh, when I went to Europe? Nothing whatsoever. I volunteered, you know, and trained with tanks down at Camp Hood, Texas, for not very long because they wanted us to get over there and start homing, so we had to learn how to run them and fuel them, you know, and make sure the guns are in order on the tanks and the armor and everything, so even right down to a flashlight. So we were prepared, but it was still no big deal with us, or with me anyhow. It probably was with people. There's a lot of people that were married. I wasn't married, and I wasn't real close. I was with my folks, but not with my sisters, and my one brother was that I was with. But other than that, no big deal.
What was your time like in Europe?
Well, I hauled 49,000 miles that year out of Patton, nearly a year, and hauled hundreds of tanks to him, and I didn't like him. I think maybe you got the history of what I run into him three times, and I don't know whether you have it on this or not. But,
yeah. Not yet. We're getting there.
Okay.
What did you think of Patton before you met him?
Well, I just heard about him, how he was pushing the troops, and that he wanted, he'd send back people to the back, you know, and get those tanks up there. We need them. Well, they did need them, because they were, the tanks came first, and then the infantry were right behind them. The artillery's back blasting those and planes. But it was after I met him that is when I didn't like him. I didn't like the way he acted, and I didn't like the way he wore those guns and slouchy pants. I just didn't. I'll tell you, if he wasn't a general, I'd have wound up on him. No, I didn't like him. I might as well tell you the three occasions that. Let's see, the first one was unloading the tank, and he wanted it over there. And the captain fell some trees. He said, "Oh, these trees are in your road, aren't they?" And I said, "Well, I can't get a tank in there." He said, "You got 5,000 foot of primacord on that trailer, haven't you?" "Yes." Four or five times around the base and set it off, and the tree went off. It right next to ground. So cleared that out. And he said he wanted them back right here. I want that tank right here, because there's going to be more tanks coming in. And so I run up on this bank, back down, and I said, "I can't get it over there, sir. I can't." He said, "God damn it, Sergeant, give a run at that hill." I went up there and spun. I got to just spin in those tracks something fierce, and it would not, you know, I knew how to drive a tank. It wouldn't go over there. Come back down. "Hey, Sergeant, look at that." He said, "Now those are good crowds." And they were a pile of dead soldiers, German soldiers in their white uniforms. And I just tore those uniforms all to hell with those tracks. "Now those are good crowds." And that was the one time.
Where were you at?
Well, I was in some little town pretty close to the front in Germany. It was in Germany. All this took place in Germany. And the other time was when he wanted two tanks on that trailer instead of one. And I said, "Well, I'm pushing pontoons up, sir, over on the other side." I said, "That's with one 45-ton tank." And I said, "My whole unit weighs about 90 ton. And those things are only supposed to be 30 to 40 ton on those pontoon bridges. Damn it, I'm giving you an order, Sergeant. Two tanks, one in the back, one in the front. I said, yes, sir, well, we never did that. There's only going to be one tank. We decided that, that there was just one tank left at that place where we picked this one up, so we got one tank on for you. Next time he flagged us down, he said, the Germans are wearing American uniforms. That was the Battle of the Bulge. And he said, when they get close enough for your Tommies, look at their shoes. If they'll have German boots on, German shoes. And he said, if they do have them mown down, well, we never saw any of them. They evidently got them before they got to, of course, we were on the road, you know, so many times, just getting tanks and taking them to a place and unloading them and right back for more. So we didn't see any, but we were prepared for them. We both had a Tommy, one right here and one on the other side, and full 50 rounds. We had a bazooka, and we had to use that bazooka a few times on these kids in a house. And, but other than that, well, never any too much problem.
So after you were done with meeting Patton, what were your impressions of him?
I didn't like him. He pushed too hard. Bradley was over him, you know. Bradley set him straight a few times, but he disobeyed orders too. When he would see an object, a bridge or something over there 4 or 5 miles, he didn't care how many men he lost to get there. That's the way my impression of Patton. He didn't care about men, and he didn't evidently, because you know, they lost thousands of lives through him. And no, he didn't. I never liked him from the first time I looked at him. And but I did feel bad that he'd die in such a pretty town as Heidelberg, and he had a car wreck and killed him. That's a beautiful town. We went through it many, many times. A very, very old town. They never bombed it or never shelled it because the history was so great at Heidelberg. You know, thousands of years and those old castles up there.
What was your interaction like with the local populace?
Well, it was, you know, it was good. We got to learn a few things in German, you know, so that and get information of where we were at. It was right after I got that ricochet, and we were going on down, and there was a bomb at an airport, and the Germans put a bomb fairly close to us. That had to have been real close, because all of a sudden, all our maps were gone, my shirt was gone, that's where the Eisenhower jacket went, and the roof was this canvas on the truck. I ditched it over and find out what, you know, if there was going to be more bombs. And that was one of the times. Then you had to go get all new maps, and I sent Eddie up to get the maps up to a place, so because you're completely lost over there in the time of war, you know. I mean, no signs up, and you had to know where you were at. So man, I just thought, I was sitting there kind of leaning back and having my feet over on the other seat, and heard a step on the step on the yard, and Eddie wasn't around, so I brought my Tommy down like that and just had it ready. And she was, you know, a little girl that looked over, and she was looking. We didn't eat candy, but we get candy bars every week. They'd get half a dozen or so, and she was looking at those, and I said, "These Hobbins, they sweet, sir?" And yes, Ina, I said to Bilger, yes, Ina. So I gave her three, and I said, you give those to your sister and brother. And so she took them, and she's a cute little thing. Boy, she didn't realize that I even had a little pressure on that. If that had been a German, he'd have been his head blown off. But of course, if it had been a German, like Ed said, the damn fool would have had it. Probably had a hand grenade, and he'd have thrown that in first. So, but that's the way it was. And we got our maps, and the truck was the only one on the road without a cab on our truck, but no big deal. had raincoats, it rained, and no big deal. That's the way it was. That's the way we turned it in, when I turned it in the Mets back where I got it originally. There was no cap on it. But I was, I told Ed, I said, I'm going to, because that blew, it hit me right there, that ricochet.
And if on your hip?
Yeah, right on the rear, right there on his hip. And it's still a hole there. And that Eisenhower jacket was all torn. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to save that jacket and put it in my barracks bag and take it home and say, this is what you look at. And I didn't have it no more. It just took my shirt and that coat and concussion from that bomb. Took everything out. And he said, it's a good thing we're sitting on our pants, because otherwise it would clean us completely out. You know, it was a concussion, but it didn't burn us. It you felt it hot on your face and arms, but it didn't, it wasn't close enough to really burn you like a concussion does. But it didn't. Everything was just gone instantly, just like that. And, I mean, you wouldn't believe something like that happened. You know, but that's the way it was.
When did you learn about the German concentration camps?
Well, we were there. We went by there the day that the one, Dachau, was evacuated, and so was my brother-in-law. He was in the 10th Mountain Division, and he was there. We went into him. Of course, I didn't know him. I wasn't married and didn't know him from beans. But we pulled over there and watched, and boy, I tell you, it wasn't, you could see those people there were, the ones that did get out of there, I don't know how they could walk, their arms were any thicker than that.
But they were about an inch?
Yeah, they were. It was terrible. No, I didn't like it, and then when we went back to Germany to visit my son that was over there in Berlin, he was in the Army. Well, it's been quite a few years ago, but long after. And so I took them down there, and we looked at camp over where, you know, they had it just the way it was in Dachau. And I said, well, unless when I got married and we were calling, he said, you know, I was there. And I said, well, the infantry. And I said, I'll tell you another guy that was there that you know real well from this area. It's and Joe Zrinka. He committed suicide later, but he was there because, did I tell you about the cherry picker? I don't know how it happened toward the end of war like that. Well, somebody wanted a cherry picker, and it was a big one. It had probably a 40, 50-foot crane out in front, and we laid it right over the top of the cabin, clear on the back of my trailer, because that's how big it was, and it was made in Belgium, and I had no idea. I said, well, if you guys can load it and tie it down, I'll take it wherever you want it. So they said it's some town up there in Germany. So we went in here with the infantry all along here, and sitting on the side, and down below the road was closed, so we had to detour around. So I cranked it around the whole truck, right angle, just like that, and that cherry picker went straight ahead for a long way, went right through a second story building, right into someone's bedroom. And Joe Jernke said, I was there, I saw that. So, small world. Mm-hmm. But no, we saw the camp when it was liberated, and we saw it later on. And I explained to them, are the people are coming out of it? And I said, I don't know how they ever made it. That damn Hitler. Well, it wasn't all together him, but it was just their regime, you know. And that's. Not a good thing. No, I didn't like that at all. But, of course, I don't like people tortured.
Can you tell me the story about how you got this knife?
They had, I think it were six of them, SS officers. and the Russians had them. The Russians were on this side of the Rhine. They weren't supposed to be, but they were on this side of the Rhine, and this one on the end down there, I see this bayonet on him. So I told Eddie, I said, I'll take my Tommy here. I think there's 8 or 9 Russians, maybe 10. And I said, I'm going up there and cut that guy's belt and take that bayonet off him. And said, they're going to kill him and make a big S. Stick him right up there and bring a big S down, just let everything out. So that's where I got that was from him. His initials are on there. And they stamped them out because of the, see, they used that stuff for, so you're not supposed to be, I can read it, but I can't, you wouldn't know it, but that was him that owned that. So I think he was a captain. And so that's how I got this. And the ring I got, that an SS officer made for me there in Metz just before the end of the war. There was still a war going on, but he made that ring for me. And I've got it. I got it with me, too. You saw it, I think. Yeah. Made out of a plexiglass from a German bomber. And, well, that guy can do it. But they speak English. And I'll say this, you know, it's a funny thing. I know the SS were, when they were fighting and they were at the upper hand, they were good. But when they quit, these guys, I think I had 5 of them. And at one time, you're supposed to have literally 3 guards to 1, just like they have in this camp. You see where they're leading that sucker along in that camp over there, and I don't know what prison it is. But it wasn't like that. They said, we're all through fighting, and there'll be no more problems whatsoever. And that was at Metz. That's when he made that ring. And he said, that's the way it is. He was from Austria, and I think he speaks good English. So I ended up, you wouldn't believe this, and that was still war going on. I let him have my Jeep to get on to Metz to a movie. I told him, I said, see that rig right over there? I said, that thing go 90 miles an hour. And I said, it's not only got a machine gun on it, it's got my Tommy right here. And I said, that Jeep will be back here. You know, as soon as that movie's over, you get back here and wake me up. And that's all there was to it. And no problem from them. Never had one, and they were all SS, had that SS right there, both armpits. So they'd been bad boys at one time, and when they were in, you know, but when they give up, they give up. Just like, but the Japs wouldn't. You had to kill them. I've never seen a Jap give up there. Well, they just literally drug them out. But out of those holes there on Kiska and on that too, but they would not give up. You had to kill them. That way you read where somebody had run into a Japanese camp that was back off the 20 years after. That was quite a story, you know, 20 years after the war was over. And those two guys, they were fully loaded. They go down the ocean and get shellfish and fish, go back in there and cook their meal. Been there for 20 years after the war. They thought the war was still going on. They were waiting for the Americans to get close so they could shoot them. So they just took them over and told them the war was over. Just go home wherever you're at. But no, I don't have anything other than I call them Japs. I don't have anything really against them. I had problems with the colored people and the Lucians and over there. And maybe it shouldn't be part of the history, but it just happened to be. And they just up in the Lucians, they'd overrun the, push us out of the road to a movie, and be hundreds of them. And finally the captain just said, well, there's about 40 of us around that machine gun. When he come out, we walked back, and he told him, come down our belly, and he said, you come any further, and he said, I'll cut you all in two. And he meant it. He meant it, mister. His thumb was on that lanyard, and that had been in them. So they, I think the ocean was the only thing that stopped them on the other side of the island. But other than that, over in Germany, they had the Red Ball Express, and they come right down the middle of the highway. Well, I've got a big tank on, 90 ton altogether, and you move over, you start breaking up that highway and start shifting down, because, boy, I'll tell you, you're using the power then. So, well, maybe I shouldn't say the rest of that story, but I weaned them. I just, when they come down screaming down there, I just moved my tank over there a little bit, my trailer, and I could see them shooting through those apple trees. You know, all along Germany and France, they had apples, prunes, cherry trees, everywhere, all the secondary roads. And I'm sure that took care of us good. But from then on, the Red Ball Express, when our retrievers are going to hauling tanks, are coming back, they moved way over. So the word got around.
Where were you when you heard news that the war was over?
Well, we was coming back. We were coming back from taking a tank, and we were coming down this hill like that, and there's a little town right down there, and we detoured out of the road. I said that in the write-up. We detoured out of the road and to see a couple of girls we knew, and dang, all kinds of tracers and stuff were going over, and so I pulled it over on the side. I said, Eddie, get down, and we each had a Tommy. I said, here they come, and the war was over. That's what they said, the war was over.
How about, where were you at when you heard the Japanese war was over?
Oh, golly. When the heck was it over? When they bombed, that's when, I think they were, it was over there before the Germans gave up, if I'm right. Maybe I'm not.
Japanese.
The two big bombs made the Japs give up. They wouldn't have given up. I think they've still been fighting. They were an ornery son of a gun. There's a lot of islands over there. But that bomb did it. You know, created a lot of problems. No, I don't know the Germans. Like I said, that's where I was when the war was ended for us. And of course, and then we volunteered to stay because we had the highest points that you get in the Army. I think it was 108 points, and we get to go out on the first plane. And I told Eddie, I said, well, let's get one of those trucks and haul some lumber down to Luxembourg and Paris. And I want to see that Leaning Tower and all that stuff up there. And but it was pretty embarrassing because we went up there, and you go to the bathroom, there's a trough along around the sidewalk, and all these girls and stuff walking by, you know. So I got in behind the building, and you ought to see those girls laughing and giggling and pointing, because I didn't want to be right out there in the open. But I think it was probably 6 weeks, and things started, people were leaving in droves, so we finally got on a P-47. And no seats in us. We sat on the floor, and they flew us back to, I don't know how many stops we made, but St. Paul, and then went at Billings here. They stopped there, and then went on to Seattle. And that's when we got all the papers done, collected our $300 discharge money, and headed for home. That's October the 20th of 45.
How did you feel about leaving your friends in the Army?
In the Army? Well, they were...
How did you feel
about
them?
Well, Ed, they're the only one I've been with, you know. And the other ones, I didn't... I never got real close to. The fact is, I didn't know anyone's first name in the Army, even Ed's name. You didn't learn first names in the Army. It was always your last name, and everyone was... He was Merrill. He didn't ever call me Angus. It was always Merrill. So, I didn't. I bought a car in Seattle, 1941 Ford Coupe, And I'd save money up, out of all that little money I made in the Army, I saved enough money to buy that $900 car there in Seattle and drove it home. Drove it over, and Ruth and I used to, when I was going together, that's the transportation we had with that 41.
What were your expectations when you were going home?
Huh?
What were your expectations about going home?
Well, you know, discharged, and it was, everything had changed. Your folks had changed, your sister, brother, everybody had changed. One sister, she was just a young twerp when we left, and she was married and raising a family when I got back, you know, 4 years and so, close to five, was made a big difference. And, but, I mean, that was just all, it didn't, you know, maybe I was just hardened up. I don't know. It didn't really bother me.
How did did people react when you returned home to you?
Well, they reacted to that I was pretty ornery when I went in, and some things. And the postmaster said, "I just can't believe how Angus's Army discipline has straightened him out," and it had. So.
What was your community like when you returned?
Well, we had moved from Bossburg, Washington, a little mining town at the McDonald's. My mother's side had been there since in the early 1850s. Angus McDonald is who I was named after. He came to help the Indians even over here. And he was, but as far as we were concerned, well, everybody made you welcome, but I got a job right away, and you had to do so many buckets a day in the quarry, and I would do 11, and then you could quit, you know, and sometimes that'd be before noon. So Ruth and I'd get in the car and go down to a show. Mammoth hamburger that big for 30 cents. $1 is all it took for a hamburger and a show back those years. Service 40, 45. No, things that, well, sure, everything had changed, you know, but you just took it with grain, that's all, you know. No big, "Oh my God, you got old, Mom." No, you wouldn't say that. She didn't.
Was it an easy adjustment?
Pardon?
Was it an easy adjustment?
Yeah, very, very easy. Yeah, I went right to work. And then when after Ruth and I got married, well, it was her dad wanted us to come out, because they were real close, her and her dad and Mom was extremely close. Wanted us to come out and farm. Well, I never farmed a day in my life. I had no idea. He sent me down first time, a tractor and a duck foot. I didn't know what either one of them was, really. Down the South 40. Well, I looked all over for the damn South 40. And finally, he came down to pick up and said, "Well, you must be lost." Yeah, I said, "I'm looking for the South 40. I had no idea what a South 40 was. But that's been a lot of years ago. So I can run the combine. We got big rigs now. And so it don't, it's altogether different." No, I took it in stride.
What benefits did you receive, and how did you use them?
You mean from the Army? Well, just the $300 I got, that's when you got discharged. Everybody got $300. Of course, I had that savings account. I bought that car in Seattle, so that was a big thing. And then we got home. Tires and sugar and everything were still rationed, you know. And so I, of course, Ruth would, she'd just about have a, just thinking about it, when we were there, sure, my brother lived along, and they tried to make a road through there, and it keeps sinking down too close to the ocean, too close to the bay, and get muddy. So they had a big pickup load, or a truckload, a Jimmy truckload of sugar. 100-pound sacks of sugar. They corduroy that road or that entire thing so they get back out there. And tell her that all that sugar is probably still up there. And they were begging for sugar. They had to use honey. A lot of honey was used over here for sugar. And out there on the farm or anywhere else. And here we were. It wasn't, I didn't do it, my brother did, and his, out to his section, used it for still logs and stuff they didn't have. They just used those big bags of sugar. And they got out there with it, and the truck was still out there when I left back. I don't know what it was going out there for to begin with. You always walked out there for 5 miles along the edge of the road, and there was, I went out to see him one time, and they just come down off a glacier with a bear, and there's a guy laying in the ocean. His hands were on the rocks, and the water was washing up to his head. I went over and pulled his hair back, and he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm waiting for that." He said, "I'm drunk, and I'm waiting for that tide to go out so I can walk along the beach." He was alive. I picked him by the hair and went, he said, "What the hell are you doing?" Boy, I tell you, I thought he was dead. Had a hold of a rock, and the whole water was working up. But it went out, and he was all right, but he was just drunk. So when he didn't lose his grip and drowned.
What about the war made the biggest impact on you?
Well, again, the biggest impact, as I've already told you, you did a lot of those things. In the Army, like saving that ship and turning these guys loose, whoever it was, all night long they marched right by us. You hear them walking real close, no sound, no light, no nothing, pitch black. And you think about those things, but you don't, there's nothing to do about it. Whenever your records are all burned up, 72, the big fire they had back there, and they made it very clear I had no records left, or anyone in my outfit, none of us had any records, so there's nothing you could do about a Purple Heart or any other thing that you were promised. You couldn't do a thing about it because your records were gone.
How would you sum up your service?
Pardon?
How would you sum up your service?
I liked it. Yeah. Skiing in Alaska and hunted for the Army up there and got to see my brother every month, and we just had fun going down to Washington. It is another thing, maybe I shouldn't say that on there, but those Arkansas boys had they had Molly the Moose, and she was stump croak. Like a lot of these cowboys in the early days, they had their horses stump broke, their cows, and this moose, this old Molly the Moose, well, somebody got a bad disease and gave her the, so they butchered her and fed her to the officers. But that was the end of old Molly the Moose. We'd seen her many times, and our sergeant, the Archie boys had her down there, so a lot of them didn't use anyone but her. What else do you have?
What image from your service sticks with you the most?
Pardon me?
What image from your service sticks with you the most?
Oh, I don't know. I just... The thing most is that, I made $30 a month. You figure that out 12 months, I think that's $360 a year that we made, $360 a year. And that's not including that first 4 months at $21. I'm talking about $30. And now, heck, they're making a lot of them making that much in a day. I mean, it's just different, when the wheat price is up, heck, I take a check in the bank for $300,000, just my name on it. Another one, same time, for $80,000, just selling wheat. And as a far cry, I used to kind of compare my own. I didn't compare with anyone else, but I compared with my own. You know, imagine making $30 a month, and you work for it. You know, we were unloading coal and or sewer or freight of some kind, and you're doing all those things. And you thought, that's kind of pay you got. Well, you, that, you think about that. But now, now I make more Social Security a month than they, you know, back then you made in a year by a long ways. But that's the way it is. That's just the way it is. It's just something that has already happened. It's history, and it's all true. I mean, no need to complaining about it. You know, the Army is good pay now. My granddaughter's a lieutenant now in the Army, so I'll know what she makes compared to what a sergeant made back then. The most I ever made in the Army was $71 a month. Sergeant. That's the most, and then I got $10 more when I got old fogey. After years, 3 years in the service, you got old fogey, and that was $10 more. So I did get that.
Would you do it again?
Well, under the circumstances I was in, you bet I'd do it again in a minute. But if I was single, and had someone, you know, that had to go in, like my brother, boy, I'd go in a minute. You know, just the outfits I was in, you was close to that artillery, and you was close to the bombers, but you was never really up front like the artillerymen or the infantrymen, or the tank. We gave them furnished the tanks, and they weren't very far over there, you know, firing them, but we were far enough away that they couldn't get us, unless it was by planes. And we unloaded those things, got out of there in a hurry. Except arguing a little bit there with old Patton. And I still, of course, there's guys that's in the know-how and in the rule and right in our country right today that I've never talked to one single person, including the women, that wouldn't like to slap that smear